Joe Fox awoke early, before daylight, pausing only to look in the girl's direction to make sure she was sleeping. He gently laid his rifle beside her. With only his bow and quiver, he disappeared into the forest that surrounded the tiny clearing. He thought his best chance to get a shot at a deer would be a few hundred yards below his camp, so he followed the stream down until he came upon a game trail. He figured that this might be a spot where the deer came to drink, so he sat down beside a sizable tree and waited. Near the camp, a menacing figure knelt, also beside a large tree, and he watched the camp intensely. Lame Horse hesitated, scanning the clearing, searching for the man whose empty blanket he could see on the opposite side of the fire from the sleeping woman. Cautious of the possibility of walking into an ambush, he crept closer to the very edge of the clearing and waited. When minutes passed with no sign of the huge white man, Lame Horse became impatient. The sun was coming up, its fingers already stealing through the trees. Still, the white man was nowhere to be seen. As a precaution, Lame Horse turned to look behind him. There was nothing. Behind the sleeping woman, he could see his little white mare standing beside a paint pony. And he began to wonder, remembering the large bay that Starbo had ridden before. Shifting his gaze back to the woman, he noticed the object lying beside her bed. As the sun began to break through the pre-dawn gloom, he could better make the object out and realized it was the repeating rifle. He was astonished to think that the white man had left the deadly rifle with the woman and gone to relieve his bowels or look for food. But it didn't matter where he was if Lame Horse could get his hands on that rifle. He would have the power. Taking a last look around the clearing with no one else in sight, he got up with an arrow notched in his bowstring and moved quickly across the clearing. He paused for a moment to gaze at the sleeping woman, casting a churlish grin upon her scarred face. Then, he carefully reached down and removed the rifle from her blanket. Unable to contain the feeling of power now within him, he thrust the weapon over his head in one hand and threw his head back. Callie was instantly snatched from a deep sleep.
Where's the white man?
With the shocking realization that the nightmare she once again found herself in was real, Callie couldn't answer.
Where is he?
Right behind you, you flathead son of a bitch.
The arrow struck him in the throat. His eyes stared wildly at Joe as the knife was about to be drawn across his windpipe.
It is Joe Fox of the Piegan Blackfeet who sends you to the dark place. You're safe now. Are you all right?
I think so.
He was alone. There are no others, so you'll be all right now.
Joe freshened the fire before turning to leave again.
I'll be right back. I killed a nice young doe that I left in the woods back there. There's also a black horse tied up to a tree up the slope a ways. We both got saddles now.
Since there was no longer a sense of danger from the Salish warriors, they remained in their camp for the rest of that day while Joe skinned and butchered the deer. They both ate roasted venison until they could hold no more, and Joe showed Callie how to smoke most of the rest of the meat to use later on. It was a healing time for Callie. More than the physical rest, she was able to recover some of the confidence that had been a characteristic when he first met her. The mental scars were far from healing, and in all likelihood would never be forgotten completely. But she felt comfortable in Joe's company, and she was glad that it was he who was there to help her, not her parents. Maybe, she thought, she'd be able to face him by the time they returned to Missoula Mills. Thinking back now on her horrible captivity, she realized that her prayers for rescue had all been for Joe. And in answer to those prayers, he had come for her. They came out of the mountains and descended into the valley of the Bitterroot, striking the river at a point where tall ponderosa pines stood guarding a sandy bank. Looking north up the broad valley, Joe figured they were 2 days from her parents' camp at Missoula Mills. Upon Callie's insistence that she was tired, they made camp by the river early in the day, although there were still a good 2 hours of daylight left. She didn't want to confess that she was really not ready for the journey to end. She secretly wished it would take a week to get to Missoula Mills. To Joe, she would only confess that she was reluctant to meet her mother and father and the rest of the people she had traveled with from Dakota until she had regained her strength. Although she had no mirror to verify it, she was pretty certain that she looked as if she'd been mauled by a grizzly, which was not too far from what had actually happened to her. There were bound to be many questions asked, knowing that it would be next to impossible to ignore. She did the only thing she could at the moment, and that was to stall, playing upon Joe's patience and hoping the extra time would give her a chance to take better control of the mental anguish of a reunion after her abduction. She longed to see her mother and father, but she dreaded to have them see her. When the 2-day journey stretched into a third day, Joe decided that it was time for Callie to face her family and friends. After plenty of rest and solid food, she had apparently recovered her physical strength, so she might as well get it over with. He'd told her as much on the morning of the third day, when they had camped the night before just 12 miles from Missoula Mill.
You're right. I know I've been dragging my feet. I just dread for everyone to see me like this.
Callie, you're not to blame for what happened to you. You're not guilty of a damn thing. As far as how you look, I think you're looking fit and fine now. Most of the bad places have healed over pretty good. Just a few little pink scars on your face. Those bruises on your arms and legs are already turning yellow. They'll be gone in a few days.
I swear, Joe Fox, you're about the poorest liar I've ever seen.
Well, you look fine to me. But you might as well go on back and let them all take a good look at you, and then you can get on with your life.
His words sent a sharp pain through her heart, but she knew he was right. She couldn't hide in the bushes all the rest of her life.
All right, let's quit lollygagging here by the fire and go home.
Seeing the sudden appearance of Joe and Callie, the entire population of the cave village came to meet her, and Callie forgot the fears that had dwelt upon her for the past 3 days. And the reluctance she had felt for seeing everyone again disappeared, replaced by an overpowering feeling of joy at the sight of her parents running to receive her. Beaming with the joy of the homecoming, Callie slid down from her horse and ran to embrace her parents. Joe had not dismounted, preferring to keep out of the way. He reached down to take the mare's reins and led the horses aside before stopping to witness the homecoming. It went as he had hoped at first, with mother and father happily embracing their daughter and the crowd of well-wishers closing in around them. But then Jake took a step back to look closely at his daughter. The crowd saw then what struck Jake, the scarred and battered countenance that once was the face of an angel. Jake's face blanched.
No!
He turned away, his fists clenched, his face twisted by anger. It was the worst thing that could have happened from Joe's point of view, and he saw the unfortunate results immediately. Joe looked at Callie and saw the light of joy disappear from her face, to be replaced by the haunting look of panic and despair. Cora, realizing the damage her husband's damning reaction had caused, sought to minimize the hurt to her daughter.
Come on, honey. Let's go home.
She led her toward their cave. Malcolm Lindstrom and Pete Watson walked over to join Joe.
I knew if anybody could bring her back, it'd be you. She looks like she took a hell of a beating, poor thing. It's a damn shame.
What about Starbo?
He got away.
Joe explained that Callie had been taken by a flathead hunting party.
I was hoping you'd catch that son of a bitch and settle up with him for murdering Brad and Nancy. Me and Pete gotta go back and give our families the bad news. I ain't looking forward to that. It'd be easier if I could say the man who killed him is dead.
I ain't done looking for Starbo yet.
You ain't figuring on going on to Oregon with these folks, then?
Reckon not.
I think Chadwick and some of the others are hoping to persuade you to go along to lead them across the mountains.
It ain't likely. I got things I gotta do. They don't need me to take them. If what folks say about the new wagon road to Walla Walla is true, they ought to be able to follow it.
Which way do you figure Starbo went?
I'm guessing he headed for the mining towns, like Butte or Helena.
Me and Pete are gonna head back home. I ain't too sure we can find our way back the way we came. If you're heading that way, maybe we could go with you.
I'll tell you what. I'll take you to Butte. You know how to find your way back to Bismarck from there.
Good enough. I appreciate it. Especially since we don't know friendly engines from hostiles. When are you planning to start out?
In the morning at sunup. If you ain't ready to ride by then, I'll figure you changed your mind.
As he had done before he'd left the little congregation by the river the first time, Joe made his camp in the cottonwoods away from the caves. He was to receive two visitors before he turned in for the night.
Hello, the camp!
Joe looked up to see Jake Simmons approaching his fire. He didn't respond. He just laid aside the bridle he was repairing and watched as the little man drew near.
I heard Pete Watson say you was leaving in the morning, and it wouldn't be right if I didn't come thank you for bringing Callie back. Me and Coro want you to know we appreciate what you've done for Callie and us.
Joe responded with only a nod.
I reckon we could pay you a little something for your trouble. It wouldn't be much. We ain't got much.
You know, Jake, that's the second time you've insulted me. First time was when you let me know I wasn't good enough to keep company with your daughter. And now you're asking me if I want money for bringing her home?
Well, I'm sorry. I reckon I didn't have any business saying...
It doesn't matter one way or the other. You've said your piece. Was there anything else you wanted?
No. Guess not. Well, I reckon that's it.
I'm leaving that little white mare for Callie. The two of them seem to hit it off real good.
I'll tell her.
It was later in the evening when his second visitor arrived. He was just about ready to roll up in his blanket when Callie made her way through the dark cottonwoods to find his camp.
How did you get out this late?
I told them I was going to the toilet.
Your pa was here.
I know. He came back muttering something about a hard-headed engine. They say you're leaving in the morning.
I am.
Were you going without telling me goodbye? Well, Mr. Joe Fox, you don't get to do that with me. I haven't thanked you enough for what you did. I can never thank you enough as long as I live.
You don't have to thank me, Callie. Nothing could have kept me from going after you.
I know that. And I want to thank you for it.
Well, you're welcome. Are you doing okay?
Yes. If they ever quit staring at me when they don't think I can see them. Where are you going from here? Mama heard Malcolm Lindstrom say you were going after Starbo. I hope that's not true.
Well, I reckon it's true enough.
That man's a monster. I'm afraid for you. If you're doing this for me, I don't want you to. It's over and done with, and it's best if you just forget him.
He owes for what he did to you, Callie. But there's the other thing, too. He murdered Bradley and Nancy Lindstrom. He stole the money that belonged to all of you. A man like that ain't got no right to live on this earth. And I reckon I'm the one who the cards were dealt to.
Callie?
Callie!
I guess they're looking for you. You'd better go on back. They're worried about you.
You take care of yourself, Joe Fox. You'll be in my prayers.
I'm obliged. You'd better go.
You're right. Joe, I... Well, thank you, Joe.
She turned to go.
Callie, if you ever need me, if you can get the word to me that you need me, I'll come.
She wasn't sure how to respond to him. Were his words a confession of genuine affection, as she so desperately wished, or words of pity for her plight? Fearful that she might force him into an awkward position if she interpreted his declaration to be more than simple courtesy, she merely turned and disappeared into the darkness. The next morning, Joe Fox led Pete and Malcolm away from the caves that had seen him through the winter. He set a comfortable pace that the horses could maintain for a long while, knowing that he could cover ground quickly until reaching the place where he would start tracking Starbow. As best he remembered, it had been a 2-day ride to the little grassy clearing with the pine tree growing out of a boulder. It would be a shorter trip this time, and as it turned out, the time was shortened to a little over a full day, allowing them to arrive at the clearing the morning of the second day.
This is the place where that bastard traded Callie to the Injuns?
That's right.
A few minutes later, Joe found the tracks he was looking for. He paused and let his eyes follow the direction indicated by the faint hoof print. Picking a point that looked like the easiest way to head up over the next ridge, he started toward it. Pete and Malcolm followed.
There's a long valley beyond this line of hills. I expect that's where he's headed. If he follows the valley far enough, he'll come to Deer Lodge.
What's that?
A town. I've never been there, but I've heard that there's a prison there.
Prison? Well, damned if Starbow ain't going to the right place.
I don't reckon he'll turn himself in.
Close to nightfall, they came to a small trading post sitting on the bank of the river. There was a crude sign painted on a wide board that proclaimed the establishment Lowry Store.
I don't know about you fellers, but I could use a drink of liquor. It's been a while.
A little snort would go good right now. How about it, Joe?
Maybe.
It had been a lot longer since Joe had imbibed strong spirits. Not since a French trapper had shared a jug with him when he was learning English with Father Paul. He'd been a little cautious about drinking ever since. The fiery liquid had sneaked up on him after several drinks and robbed him of his reflexes, and he decided he did not like being drunk. As a result, on the occasion when a drink was offered, which was very seldom, he limited himself to one drink. It was soon after that when his Blackfoot father and mother were killed by Crow Indians, and Joe decided his path was to live alone in the mountains where there were no thoughts of drink. Frank Lowry stepped out on the porch of his little store.
Hey, evening, gents. And what can I do for you fellas?
We sure could use a drink of liquor. We've been riding for a couple days and need something to cut the dust in our throats.
Sorry, fellas. Yeah, looks like you're out of luck here. I don't sell whiskey. Nothing but dry goods and staples for the few families that live in the valley. I wish I had some myself. I'd offer you a drink. But you're going to have to go on into Butte to find a saloon. I got flour and salt and sugar and tobacco. Everything else you might need.
Lowry took a sideways look at their tall friend dressed in animal skins with his long hair and two braids.
And for your friend here... I even got some bright beads and calico cloth.
Listen here, mister. This ain't no engine. This is Joe Fox. And if it wasn't for him, there's a lot of white folks that wouldn't be alive right now.
Now, hold on there, friend. I didn't mean no harm. I thought I was doing you a good turn.
No harm done. Maybe you can do us a good turn at that. We're trying to catch up with a feller. Might be he came by here. Big feller. Riding a big dun horse, maybe 2 weeks ago.
If it's the one I think it is, I wish he'd stop back by. He bought a lot of goods. Tobacco, sugar, bacon, coffee. He wanted whiskey, too. Wish I had something to sell him. Ooh, he had plenty of money.
That sounds like our friend. Was his name Starbo?
Might have been at that.
Much obliged. How far is it to Butte?
15 miles. Now, listen, mister. I didn't mean no harm. Stop in if you're back this way again. I can give you a good price on any supplies you need. Hope you catch up with friend.
The three travelers were amazed to find Butte a regular city, something none of them had expected, with several crossing streets and a main street with stores and shops for most anything a person could want to buy. Having never been in a city of any size, Joe was more astonished than his two companions, and he couldn't help but gape openly at the many people scurrying along the busy street like so many ants in a hill.
I'm thinking if I was Starbo, riding into town like we are now, I'd most likely head for the first saloon I came to.
Malcolm glanced at Pete to see if his brother-in-law had picked up on Joe's sudden confusion. Pete took a quick glance at Joe, whose gaze had been captured by a mannequin dressed in a woman's lacy frock, complete with parasol.
I expect that's what he'd do, all right. What do you think, Joe?
Huh? Oh, yeah, you're right.
Joe looked down the street, seeing the Copper King.
There's one there.
I could use that drink we were trying to get last night.
They tied their horses up in front of the saloon. Still staring at everyone who walked by, Joe pulled his rifle out of the sling as he stepped up on the walk.
I doubt you'll need that rifle in there.
Well, I ain't gonna leave it out here.
Joe, have you ever been in a town before?
No, not like this one. Not with so many white people.
Well, me and Pete have, so we'll help you get the information you're looking for. Right, Pete?
Right. What do you intend to do if we find Starbo here in town?
Kill him.
Well, now, that might be a problem. You see, they have lawmen here whose job it is to bring murderers like Starbo to justice. They don't just let everybody take the law into their own hands.
I don't see how they can stop me.
Damn it. Joe, you gun a man down in the streets and they'll throw you in jail for the rest of your life. It don't matter if the man deserved killing or not. And if there's one thing I know about you, it's that you won't do so good locked up.
Starbo killed your brother and his wife. And you know what he did to Kelly. He deserves to be killed. It ain't no business of the people in this town.
They'll make it their business. White folks live by laws, and Butte's a law-abiding city now.
It's a dumb way to live.
Me and Pete are just trying to keep you from spending the rest of your life locked up in a little cell away from your mountains. Listen, why don't we just try to find out if he's in town? If he is, we can maybe get the sheriff to arrest him, and they'll take care of his punishment.
What if we see him and he shoots me?
Well, then you can shoot him.
That don't make no sense to me. If I shoot him, the sheriff will lock me up. But if he shoots me, I can shoot him. Why can't I just shoot him and be done with it?
I don't know. You just can't.
I'll do what you say. When we find him, we'll go get the sheriff. Okay?
Both men nodded.
What the hell?
The bartender saw the three strangers walk into the saloon. Amazed, he stood gawking at them as they approached the bar.
Howdy. Would like a shot of your good whiskey and maybe a little information.
Well, in the first place, we don't serve no Injuns in here. And in the second place, I'm gonna have to tell you to take that rifle outside.
I don't want any of your fire water. Give my friends the whiskey they asked for.
The bartender said nothing, but hastened to set two shot glasses on the bar and fill them. Pete and Malcolm both tossed their drinks down.
Now, we're looking for a friend of ours named Starbo. Big feller. You seen him?
Can't say as I have. Any of you fellers know somebody named Starbo?
Not a soul spoke up. They continued to stare at Joe.
Much obliged, then. That's all we wanted to know.
With every eye upon him, they walked out to the street again. It occurred to Joe that the first place he should have checked was the stables. If Starbow had spent any time at all in Butte, he would have to stable his horse. He and the two other men went down the street to speak to the owner of the stable.
Yeah, big fella. Riding a big old broad-chested dun. I remember him. Left his horse with me for 3 nights. Paid good money, too. He rode out of here day before yesterday.
You recall his name?
Not right off. Started with an S. Starman or something. Shorty Wesson over at the Miner's Chance mine, know. The big fella spent a lot of time over there.
Starbow?
Yeah, that sounds about right. What are you looking for him for?
We're just some friends of his, and we heard he was in town.
Did he say where he was heading?
Why, no. He didn't say which way he was going.
Much obliged.
They turned to leave.
He did say he'd be back in a day or two.
Much obliged.
They walked back to their horses.
Maybe we ought to check with the sheriff.
Not yet. We'll go to the Miner's Chance.
All right, but why don't you just let me and Pete go in this time? Have you got any white man's clothes?
The look on Joe's face was answer enough.
You know, I've been thinking about this thing, about talking to the sheriff. What makes you think he's going to take our word for it that Starbow done all them things? He don't know us from Adam's house cat. And he might not give a shit about something that happened up at Missoula Mills.
Well, I don't know. We're just trying to keep the law off of Joe's back.
The visit with Shorty Wesson, the owner of the Miner's Chance Saloon, produced positive information. Shorty was quick to say he certainly did remember Starbow, a big man with a big thirst, and apparently plenty of money to satisfy that thirst. He had rented a room upstairs over the bar for 2 nights and paid in advance. According to Shorty, Starbow said he'd be back to hold his room for him. The question now was what to do while awaiting Starbow's return. There was no decision to be made by Joe regarding where he would wait. He had no money for stables, so he would make his camp outside of town in the hills. During the day, he would select a spot where he could watch the goings and comings at Nate's stable. The decision for Pete and Malcolm was more complicated than Joe's. Now that they had arrived in Butte, they knew their way home, and they no longer needed Joe to guide them. They camped with him on the first night, and Pete spent a portion of the evening arguing with Malcolm about the wisdom of getting involved in what might develop into a serious gunfight. He understood his brother-in-law's desire for vengeance. Even if they found Starbow and came out on top, there was still a good possibility of getting locked up by the law. It had been a long winter for them, away from their families back east. They had fought both the weather and the Indians and lost family members and friends. But there was an obligation to return home to the folks who had passed the winter without them. They longed to see the monster Starbow receive his just deserts, but they wondered whether they were pushing their luck a bit too far to stay and be a part of Joe's plan for justice. It was Pete's insistence that Joe would likely run Starbow to the ground and settle up for all of them that finally swayed Malcolm to his line of thinking. They announced their decision to Joe over the evening campfire.
Joe, me and Pete have been talking it over, and we think it's way past time that we got ourselves back home to take care of our families. We're still looking at a month and a half or 2 months before we get home, if we start tomorrow.
I think that's a good idea. I appreciate your helping me. Those fellas in the Copper King looked like they'd like to take a shot at me.
There ain't no hard feelings about us taking off before you get settled with Starbow, is there? Because if there is...
There ain't. Starbow is for me to take care of, and I don't reckon I need any help with that.
The next morning, Malcolm and Pete were up early, packing their saddlebags, getting ready to start out to the southeast on a course that would eventually take them to the Yellowstone. At Pete's insistence, Joe accepted a gift of an extra bag of coffee beans and a box of .44 cartridges.
Put one of these in Starbo's ass.
I hope your trip back to your families is a good one.
Thanks. Take care. That Starbo is a dangerous son of a bitch.
You watch your back.
I will. You watch yours. There's still some stray bands of Sioux and Crow hanging around the Yellowstone.
With that, each of the men went their separate ways. Joe Fox was not the only person keeping an eye on Butte's business. For the past morning and night, Starbo had kept vigilance on a small bank on the northeast side of Butte. He still had a large portion of the $250 he had stolen from Bradley Lindstrom, but judging by the rate he was spending, he was going to need a lot more than that. And the little miner's bank of Butte was the perfect solution to his problem. Most of the time, while he had watched it, there were only two people there, and one of them was a woman. The building was sitting in a grove of trees all by itself, offering cover for anyone with a notion to rob it. After a night on a creek bank from which he had set up his lookout, he satisfied himself that no one ever came by the creek to check on the bank. It was almost too easy. He decided he would go back to the miner's chance for one more night of drinking and maybe a turn with a whore, then hit the bank as soon as they opened the following morning. Just after sunrise, Starbo rode into the stable and dismounted. Surprised to see someone so early, Nate Lewis came from the tack room.
Good morning. You're getting in mighty early this morning. You must have been riding all night. There was some fellas looking for you just yesterday.
Who was it?
Said they was friends of yours. Three fellas. Two white and one that looked like an Injun.
Starbo froze for a long second while a sensation akin to a bolt of lightning shot up his spine. He looked quickly over his shoulder toward the open door he had just entered. Then, without a word and barely a glance at Nate, he stepped back up in the saddle. Later that morning, Joe rode up to the stable and dismounted. He decided it would not hurt to check with the owner to make sure Starbo hadn't ridden in early to stable his horse.
Morning.
Morning. That fella you were looking for? The one you said was a friend of yours? He was here early this morning, but he let out when I told him you fellas asked about him.
Don't reckon he said where he was going.
He didn't say nothing. Not a mumbly word. Didn't look like he was too eager to see you.
Much obliged.
There was a new set of problems now. Starbo knew that he was being trailed. Maybe he had hightailed it out of town right away. Or maybe he was waiting in ambush somewhere, hoping to get a shot at Joe. Butte was a sizable city. There were many places to hide.
Maybe he ran and maybe he didn't. But I gotta be sure he ain't holed up here somewhere.
Joe decided he would have to search every place he reasonably could, hoping Starbo was still in town, because he had no way of knowing which way he ran if that was the case.
Might as well start with the miner's chance.
While Joe headed toward the saloon, Nate Lewis went to the sheriff's office. Deputy Jim Blackburn was sitting at the desk.
Where's Pedersen?
Well, Sheriff Pedersen's gone fishing. He left me in charge. What do you want, Nate?
There's just something I think you ought to know. Maybe trouble, maybe not. But it sure looks like somebody's looking to kill somebody.
Nate went on to tell Blackburn about the visitors to his stable.
That one Injun? He looks like he ain't been told that all the wild Injuns have been run out of this valley.
I expect he might be the same Jasper that Tom Branch said came in on the Copper King yesterday. Ain't much I can do about it if they ain't broke no laws yet. Tom said he didn't sell him no whiskey. So he ain't done nothing yet.
I'm just telling you that he was a pretty dangerous-looking fella. Thought you'd want to know.
I appreciate it, Nate. I'll have a little look around, see if I can find him. Maybe find out what he's doing in town. You know, just to let him know we got an eye on him.
Shorty Wesson was wiping the bar down with an old dirt rag. He paused when an Indian came through the door, walking up to the bar.
Whoa, 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 here now. I can't sell you any.
Man named Starbo. Has he been in today?
Well, now, who wants to know?
Joe laid his rifle up on the bar in front of him. He was in no mood to bandy words with the bartender.
I do. Has he been in here today?
No, mister, he ain't been in for a couple of days.
He's got a room upstairs. Maybe he's up there.
I told you, he ain't here. He wanted me to hold the room for him, but he ain't come back. It's just an empty room.
What number?
Like I said, he ain't here.
I ain't got no time to waste with you.
Number 7, into the hall. But there ain't nobody in any of them right now.
Much obliged.
Joe bolted up the steps, 3 at a time. He worked his way down the hall, opening each door as he passed. All the rooms were empty, just as Shorty had said. When he got to number 7, he paused a bit longer, making sure there was no evidence that Starbo had checked out. Shorty hadn't lied. If Starbo had been there before, he was long gone now. Considering the probability that the bartender might have sent for the law while he was searching the room, he went to the window. As he had figured, there was a porch below on the first floor. Slipping his rifle strap over his shoulder, he opened the window and lowered himself out to arm's length. With his fingertips holding on to the windowsill, his feet were only about 5 feet from the porch roof. He dropped. Running across the wide roof, he made his way to the far front corner where his horses were tied below. He'd covered a good deal of Main Street before Deputy Blackburn caught up with him.
Now hold on there, mister. Just what in the hell you think you're doing?
Minding my own business, I reckon.
Maybe you better come with me.
Why? Where are you going?
Why? Because I'm the law in this town, that's why. Maybe you better hand over that rifle, too.
I haven't broken any of your laws. Is it against the law to look for someone?
The thing is...
I won't hand my rifle over to you or any man. Now go about your business and let me go about mine.
Mister, you look and talk like a white man, but dressed up like an Injun like that, you're upsetting the folks around here. Just what you aiming to do?
I told you, I'm looking for someone, and if you don't mind, I'm in a hurry.
What are you planning to do when you find him?
Before Joe could answer, a man came charging down the street on foot.
The bank! Somebody robbed the bank! Wallace Tolbert's been shot!
Where? Which bank?
Miner's Bank. Mr. Tolbert shot dead, I think. Marcy Jessup's hurt. She got cracked on the head.
All right, now run on over to Doc Murphy's. Tell him what you told me.
Joe followed along behind the deputy. He had a strong hunch that Starbo might have had something to do with the bank holdup. If he guessed right, he might be able to pick up his trail. When he arrived at the bank, right on Blackburn's heels, there was already a small crowd of spectators gathered. He dismounted and walked to a window on the side of the building where he could see and hear what was going on inside. He saw a body lying face down on the floor, and a young woman sitting on the floor with her back against the wall. She was bleeding from a scalp wound, and the blood had left a scarlet trail down her neck and stained her collar and blouse. Another woman was at her side, trying to comfort her.
All right, all you folks go on outside. There ain't nothing for you to see in here.
The half dozen or so who had come inside to gawk slowly shuffled toward the door.
You can stay, Mrs. Stancil.
Blackburn turned his attention to the wounded girl.
I've already sent for Doc Murphy, Marcy. He ought to be here pretty quick.
He glanced around him before continuing, taking in the signs of damage to the cage and counter before questioning Marcy.
Tell me what happened, Marcy. How many were there?
There was only one man. He kicked the front door open just as Mr. Tolbert was locking it and said to give him the money in the vault. He told me not to scream, but I couldn't help it. I was so scared. And that's when he hit me. I don't know what it was he hit me with. The rifle he was holding, I guess. I didn't remember anything for a few minutes, I reckon. The next thing I do remember was hearing a gunshot. That's when he shot Mr. Tolbert.
What did he look like?
He...
He was big. A great big man.
You think you would recognize him if you saw him again?
Yes. I didn't see his face. He had bandana tied around his face, but I'd recognize him. He looked like a big bear.
Well, which way did he go after he left the bank?
I don't know. I couldn't see where he went. I was too scared.
While Blackburn was trying to get his priorities in order, Joe had already seen all he needed to know. He had noticed a set of large footprints leaving the back door of the bank, heading into the woods. They had to be the tracks of Starbow. He led his horses into the woods and followed the tracks along a creek bank. Joe found the spot where Starbow mounted his horse. He searched more closely until he found a print in a rocky slide next to the water, and he knew that Starbow had ridden into the creek, hoping not to leave tracks. He hadn't bothered to hide his footprints when he ran from the bank, but from this point on, he was intent upon leaving no trail at all. He was almost successful. Joe searched the banks of the creek carefully, upstream and down, on both sides, with no sign of exit from the water. After spending the biggest part of what was left of the morning scouring the bank, he had a stroke of luck. There were several places along the creek where rocks protruded down to the water. He had considered them all as possible points of exit, but he found no tracks beyond them. Then something caught his eye. It was not a hoof print, merely a slash in the dirt at the edge of a flat rock, some 60 yards upstream from the point where Starbow had entered the water. On closer inspection, he decided it was possibly made when a hoof missed solid footing on the rock and slipped off the edge, scraping a small scar in the bank. It wasn't much to go on, but there wasn't anything else, so he paused to take a look at the possible lines of escape. There were only two that seemed reasonable choices to Joe. Starbow could have continued on down the narrow valley, following the creek, or he could have ridden down a heavily wooded draw that would eventually lead to a line of low mountains covered with pines and spruce. Joe looked toward the hills and the large forest of lodgepole pines on the lower slopes.
That's where I'd head if I was trying to lose someone following me.
This would be the obvious path to take if one was in a hurry. So he led his horses along the trail while he carefully searched for a hoof print that would tell him he was on the right track. He searched all afternoon, but he could not come up with a single print.
Did I guess wrong?
Maybe Starbow chose to follow the creek south after all, with the intention of taking the least obvious escape route. Joe pondered the possibility for a moment.
Doesn't make sense. If Starbow followed the creek, it would lead him back to the south end of town.
He wondered then if he had been mistaken about the slash in the creek bank by the rock. Maybe it wasn't made by a horse's hoof at all, but misinterpreted because of a lack of solid sign. Now he was frustrated with himself. Starbow wasn't smart enough to ride off, leaving no trail to follow. Already hours behind Starbow, Joe decided he had no choice but to make camp for the night and pick up the trail in the morning. He went back to the creek to make his camp, where there was water for the horses and a little grass for grazing. After building a fire, he settled in with some coffee and deer jerky for his supper. Thoughts turned from the man he hunted to the last night he had camped in the cottonwoods near the Clark's Fork River. He could still feel the touch of her body close to his, and her arms locked tightly around his neck. Usually, when thoughts of Callie came to him, he tried to quickly dispense with them, fearful of letting his mind wander in possible trails. But on this night, he permitted the thoughts to linger as he openly considered the possibility that the slender young girl had a deeper feeling for him beyond that of a rescuer. He had nothing to offer a woman that one could consider a promising future. He was at home in the forest, his deep in the mountains as he could get. He knew nothing of tilling the soil or raising farm animals. His ways were the way of the bow and rifle.
Why do I care anyway? She's gone now, gone to Oregon, and I got a job to do here.
He decided to put thoughts of Callie out of his mind. But it was a long time before she actually released his mind and let him sleep. Under the same full moon, Callie lay awake, her mind filled with a plethora of thoughts and questions that lacked satisfactory answers. Since she had been returned to her friends and family, her days had been restless and uncertain. Although her parents and their friends told her that she was not to blame for what happened to her, still she could not escape the curious glances from the other members of the congregation. Most of them found it extremely hard to look directly into her face when talking to her, as if her disfigured cheeks and jaw displayed the mark of the devil. There was only one person who looked into her eyes, seeing past the scars to her soul, and he was gone from her life forever. She wished now that she had told him she loved him. It may have reviled him, but she knew he would have been kind enough not to show it. She had waited all her young life to tell some special someone that she loved him, and she knew now that the opportunity would never come. Tomorrow, the congregation would bid farewell to the Missoula Valley and begin the long journey to the Oregon country and the Willamette Valley, God willing. It was to be an arduous journey with many mountains to cross, and when they reached the Willamette, she would be a world apart from the one person she trusted above all others. Tomorrow was going to be a difficult day, but even in her young years, she knew that life didn't give a person many choices. As soon as it was light enough to see, Joe was saddled up and back on the game trail that led up the wooded draw. The only sign he could discover were tracks that he had left the night before, but he was still not ready to abandon the trail. Leaving his horses to wait for him on the game trail, he climbed up through the fir trees on the side of the draw, knowing that the tracks were there. He just had to find them. About 75 feet up the steep slope, he came upon them. Due to the steepness of the side of the draw, Starbo had been unsuccessful in hiding his tracks, and he might have found it useless to even try, for they were distinct in the soft topsoil of the fir forest floor, leaving long slashes in the steepest places as the horse slipped and stumbled.
He couldn't make any progress up here. He's bound to have come back to the trail at the bottom.
Without wasting any more time on the side of the draw, Joe scrambled back to the bottom to retrieve his horses. Stepping up on the paint, he followed the game trail up the draw, and eventually he came to a point where a shod horse came down from the side and struck the trail where it fanned out at the base of a mountain. It was easy to picture the hulking fugitive as he had woven his way up through the forest of firs and lodgepole pines, riding around large outcroppings of rock as he climbed higher and higher. The careless trail of hoof prints and broken branches testified to the reckless pace he had set for his horse in an attempt to put as much distance as possible between himself and anyone following him. Once Joe reached the shoulder of the mountain, he found the trail that leveled out and led around it toward the east slope. From there, it started descending toward a narrow valley to the north. It was Joe's guess that Starbo had no specific direction in mind, but was simply running, hoping to disappear in the wilderness. Reaching the bottom of the mountain, Joe came upon a wide stream that had been hidden from the mountaintop by a thick canopy of trees. Taking advantage of the opportunity to once again disguise his trail, Starbo had ridden into the stream, causing Joe to slow down and carefully walked the paint up the stream, searching for tracks leaving the water. He followed the stream for over a quarter mile, scanning both banks intensely with no sign of tracks. With reluctance and a generous portion of impatience, he turned his horses around and retraced his steps, grudgingly admitting that the belligerent bully had outsmarted him and reversed his direction in the stream. Sure enough, he had ridden no more than 200 yards past the point where Starbo had first entered the stream when he saw the tracks leaving the water. Starbo had made no attempt to hide them. Two sets of prints clearly led across a soft bank and across the valley toward the neighboring mountain. Taken completely by surprise, Joe almost came out of his saddle. Joe just managed to pull his rifle and tumble from the saddle as the paint went down. He rolled over behind a tree, cocked his rifle, and scanned the slope above him, trying to pinpoint the source of the rifle fire. There was nothing to be seen but the dense forest that covered the side of the mountain.
Damn it. He knows where I am, but I still don't know where he is.
Knowing he couldn't afford to remain pinned down behind the tree, he didn't take time to think about it. Leaping to his feet, he made a run for the stream behind him. Running as hard as he could go, he almost reached the edge of the stream. Diving the final few feet, he landed beneath the bank. Intent upon working his way up around the deadly ambush, he crawled a dozen yards down the stream until he gained enough solid cover to make a try for the pack horse.